Thanks. I don't know about you, I'm feeling slightly sleepy. We've worked hard today. I think this is our, we're getting into our fifth hour of teaching. And there's one thing more tiring than giving talks all day, and that's listening to talks all day. So I'm conscious that you've got the harder job. I think when I'm sleeping, I can normally still speak, but I can't listen. So I'll be, let's ask for God's help to keep awake. And we're in chapter 8 of Mark's Gospel. In those days, when again a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion on the crowd, because they've been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they'll faint on the way, and some of them have come from far away. And his disciples answered him, How can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place? And he asked them, How many loaves do you have? They said, 7. And he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And they set them before the crowd. They had a few small fish. And having blessed them, he said that these should also be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied. And they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. And there were about 4,000 people, and he sent them away. And immediately he got into the boat with the disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. I don't know about you, but as I read that, I get a strong sense of deja vu. I've seen something a little bit like this before. In fact, I've seen something a lot like this before. What I want you to do in pairs, we're going to make it more interactive because we're sleepy. Turn in pairs and compare this with the feeding of the 5,000, which we just looked at in our groups, and see how many connections can you find. And I think there are a lot. So look for similarities between the two. Maybe do a table or something with the one in each column. And one clue, by the way, don't look not only for what Mark says, but also the order in which he says things, because even that might match. Thank you.
done.
Okay, let's be back. Similarities between the 5,000 and the 4,000. I'll be scribe, you call out things for me to write. Yeah, great crowd. So Mark opens the episode by telling there's a lot of people there. Yeah. Nothing to eat. Nothing to eat, no food. Yeah. Compassion. Same words. Yeah. Say again.
Late in the
evening. Okay, yeah. I'm
going to run out of space, but this is good.
Yes, it's in the desert again.
So he only tells you one time this time because he's desert times three and then desert here.
When I first wrote Dig Deeper into the Gospels, I typed it as dessert place with two S's, and it's one of the typos that the typesetter picked up. I thought then they wouldn't be hungry, would they? But it wasn't a dessert place, it was a desert place, yeah. Any others? Yes. So how many loaves? And?
In the first one, the disciples came to him and said, 7 and 8 to eat. In the second one, he took the initiative and said, I've been here 3 days. I'm not sure that's significant.
So there's a small difference, yeah, but the similarity is the disciples are at a loss both times. How are we going to feed people? Yeah.
So disciples stuck. Yeah, any others?
Disciples end up distributing the bread and fish.
Yes, good.
Same thing, command to sit, bless, break, give.
Yes. So sit, let's get all of these. This is very helpful. So I've lost it. Sit. Thanks. Gave it to the disciples to set before the people. Sit. Thanks. Gave to the disciples to set before the people. So,
sit. Thanks. Break. Gave to the disciples. Set before the people. It's identical, the language, the same phrase. I'm just going to put.
Yeah, he blessed it, yeah. They all ate and were satisfied.
Same phrase. They all ate and were satisfied. All ate and were satisfied. Leftovers. Leftovers. Then.
Yes, and one thing before that, they then number them, count them. There are 5,000 men, there are 4,000 men comes right at the end. So the count,
and the count, and then one more at the end,
they set off by boat. I mean, this is not just sort of a bit similar, this is very, very similar. And Mark has, I'd suggest, gone out of his way to make it as similar as possible. So it's not just a... that the events are the same, but his way of telling the events is the same. So he even reuses identical phrases. They ate and were satisfied. He gave it to the disciples to set before the people. He gave it to the disciples to set before the people. And the question is, why? I mean, one of my friend's phrase he used to say, parchment is expensive. By which he meant, you know, you've got to... Mark is quite brief. He's summarising 3 years of Jesus' ministry in just a small scroll, words count. So why spend so long telling us about something that we've already seen before? In particular, why not use the shorthand? So earlier we've had a long account of Jesus healing somebody, and later he just says Jesus healed various other people with various diseases. So he could just say, and Jesus healed more people, also with bread and fish. But instead he gives us the account verbatim the same. He sort of sticks out like a sore thumb. Why are we told about the feeding of the 4,000 the same? Now, if you were a liberal of 30 years ago or more, you'd say something like, Mark is a clueless compiler of historical sources, and he doesn't notice that he accidentally put in two versions of the same thing. What a fool, you know. So that he's leading with one source, and it's got Jesus fed 5,000 people, and the other one's 4,000 people, and he includes them both and doesn't even spot it. I mean, I think, give the man some credit. You know, an author who writes as carefully as we've seen Mark write is probably going to notice that in his own work, he's got two things the same. He's obviously doing it for a reason, deliberately. And what is his reason? What is his purpose? Some people have suggested that the difference is that the feeding of the 5,000 is a rescue of Jewish people, and the feeding of the 4,000 is a rescue of Gentile people. And let me give you some very subtle clues about that. So some people have said, well, look, the feeding of the 5,000, there was 12 baskets left over. Someone was asking my group about the number 12, and I said, I'm not going to say now because I want to keep my powder dry. Well, here it is. 12 is a distinctively Jewish number, the number of the 12 of tribes of Israel. So maybe that's a sort of signature number of the tribes of Israel, basketfuls. Whereas in the feeding of the 4,000, there's 7 basketfuls left over, and 7 is the complete number in the Bible, 7 days in the week. And God creates the world in 6 days and then rests on the 7th. It's like everything's finished number. So maybe it now includes everyone else as well and everything's finished. Well, I mean, maybe. But it seems a bit tenuous to me just on its own. Because why are people telling us about the number 12 and the number 7, but they ignore the number 5 and the number 2? How many loaves were there? I mean, if you can't just use numbers when it suits you and ignore them other times. So I'm sceptical about numbers, but yeah, maybe. Other people say, oh, the word for the baskets is different, which is true. In Greek, it's a different word for baskets. The chapter 6 baskets are distinctively Jewish baskets. Well, again, maybe, but this is very subtle, isn't it? I mean, Mark doesn't often expect that level of intelligence from his readers. In fact, he spells things out for you. Chapter 7, when he's talking about things being clean and unclean, he assumes that you don't know very much about Jewish customs and actually tells you, by the way, the Pharisees like to wash their dining couches and their pots and stuff. So to expect you to know the particular kinds of baskets used in first century Galilee, I think he's asking quite a lot. Other people point out, and this is maybe slightly more plausible, they point out that Jesus has crossed over to the other side of the lake. And we already know that the lake does have a Jewish side and a Gentile side. There's some clues to that. But in particular, we're told just before this, they're in the Decapolis, verse 31, chapter 7, verse 31. And the last time we met the Decapolis was back in chapter 5, when the man with the 2,000 demons went out in the Decapolis. So the chapter 5 man lives in this area. And the other thing you need to know about this area is that the demons are driven out, remember, into 2,000 pigs. Oink, splosh. In other words, that is unlikely to be an orthodox Jewish farming area. Pig farming was not high on the agenda for Pharisees. So we already know that the Decapolis side of the lake is the pig farming is the Gentile side of the lake. So the fact he's crossed over, he does the feeding of the 5,000 over there, and then he crosses the lake and he does the feeding of the 4,000 over here. Maybe that means there's a Jewish feeding and there's a Gentile feeding. Possibly. I think there's a much better reason. And I was slow to discover this, and I'm excited about it now. So let's turn back to chapter 7 and look at verse 24 to 30. From there, Jesus arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. He entered a house and didn't want anyone to know, yet he couldn't be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. He said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." And he said to her, "For this statement you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter." And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. I suspect, as I think mainly English people here, we don't handle awkwardness very well. I very much remember a family visit to a tea room in the cathedral city of Ely, near where I grew up. The kind of place with doilies on the plates and little pink flowers on the china. And then, as we were having tea, my sister let out a deafening burp at the top of her voice. And it was rather embarrassing. No one knew quite where to look. You did your best to dissociate yourself from our family member and pretend it hadn't happened. And because we were all English, everybody else in the tea room did the same, sort of looking at their feet and ignoring it. But what happened in our tea room doesn't even compare with the embarrassment of what happens here. Jesus meets a woman in some distress and basically calls her a dog. And that is very awkward. And of course, lots of people wish Jesus hadn't said it. And it goes into those books called The Hard Sayings of Jesus, you know, things that we wish Jesus hadn't said because we're embarrassed about them. Some people try to mitigate the offence by saying that Jesus uses a diminutive form in the Greek, a little dog. So maybe he's, you know, calling her a puppy. And the idea is, you know, you're cute. Like, no. No, he's calling her a dog. And he meant to call her a dog. Others point out this is a normal way for Jews to speak of Gentiles. Well, yeah, that's true. It was normal. But it's still offensive. Why is Jesus being so offensive? And I want to suggest we shouldn't ever be embarrassed by the Bible, and we shouldn't ever shy away from the things that are difficult, because there's always a good and a glorious reason for them, and I think this is no different. The fact is, Jesus didn't call the woman dog by mistake. He intended to say dog, and he knew full well how much it would have us squirming. And I think the most remarkable thing about this episode, for me, as I was looking at closely and thinking, how do I make sense of this, is the woman's response to it. "Yes, Lord," she says. And it just struck me that is not a 21st century response, is it? You can imagine somebody called, Jesus called a woman a dog nowadays, a slap on the face, a "how dare you," and possibly an appeal to the police on harassment charges. And she says, "Yes, Lord. That's fair." And that is very shocking to us. More shocking than Jesus' choice of language is her choice of response. And it just says to me, she is very, very different to 21st century readers. What is the difference? I think the difference is that she doesn't share our sense of entitlement. Jesus basically says, "You're a Gentile. Why should I help you?" And she says, "Fair point. There's no reason why you should help me. I have no claim on the children's bread," the children being the children of Israel. "But I'd be satisfied with crumbs if you can spare any." She's very humble, isn't she? She's not standing on her rights. "Jesus, you owe me a solution." The kind of shaken fist at God in there. Sometimes people ask the "why does God allow suffering" question in a very angry way. "God owes me a trouble-free life, and I deeply resent that I've got problems, and it's his fault." She doesn't feel that. "I've no right to ask you to help me. I just am hoping that you might be kind to someone scrounging for scraps. And Jesus is very, very impressed with this and says, yeah, for this reply, you can go. The demon has left your daughter. In other words, she knows that she comes empty-handed, but she goes away full. In the words of the hymn, nothing in my hand I bring. Simply to the cross I cling. Naked, come to thee for dress. Helpless, look for thee for grace. Foul, I to the fountain fly. Wash me, Saviour, or I die. It's unusual language, isn't it, for the 21st century? Even if you compare confessions, if you're in the Anglican Church, and you compare the BCP confession at the communion service with the modern one, have mercy upon us, miserable offenders, is the 16th century language. And we're sorry, we're not absolutely great. It's not quite as bad as that. But it's a very much dumbed down. She says, no, by all means call me a dog. That's too good for me, actually. I'm just scrounging. Have you got any scraps? So it's a wonderful message. And of course, theologically, she's right, because God's promises in the Old Testament weren't in the first instance for Gentiles. God's exodus, who was saved at the exodus? Israelites were. I mean, a few Egyptians sneaked out across the Red Sea as well and joined them, but mostly Egyptians were drowned and Israelites were saved. There was one Moabite family that God was merciful to, the family of Ruth, but mostly Moabites were God's enemies and they perished. Now, there was one Canaanite lady called Rahab who escaped, but mostly Canaanites in Jericho were destroyed. God was saving his people, and the Gentiles had no claim on that. The Exodus wasn't for them. In fact, even the promises of a Messiah were the promises of a Jewish Messiah. You remember how the Apostle Paul puts it in Ephesians. You were once alienated from God. Strangers to the promise. You were dogs. She says, yeah, it's fair. But then the strange thing, and I'd never really noticed this before, but the strange thing is the way that verse 27 doesn't quite follow from verse 26. Just have a look and see what I mean. Look at what she's asking for and look at how Jesus answers. Verse 26, 27, her question, his answer. Question, please cast the demon out of my daughter. Answer, no, I won't give you any food. No, I'm not asking for food, I'm asking for exorcism, right? I'm not hungry, it's just that my daughter's got a demon. Yeah, I'm not going to feed you. See, it's sort of jarring, isn't it? He's changed the category. Since when did a conversation about exorcism become a conversation about bread? Except, and some of you have already got there ahead of me, it took me quite a long time to get this, except it comes in Mark's Gospel sandwiched in between the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. And the category is, will I get a taste of the same bread, maybe leftover crumbs of the same bread that you fed the 5,000 with? Because remember, the 5,000 was all about a rescue. That was the fundamental point of it, was that this was an exodus. And she's saying, is there a little bit of exodus leftover? Could you do a little bit of rescuing also for me? And Jesus goes, yeah, I will actually, because you're so humble and you've humbled yourself. You can have a bit more. You can have some crumbs. And then, on the other side of the lake, Jesus feeds a huge crowd of 4,000 people in a Gentile area in precisely the same way as he did the 5,000. And the point is, he gives them a lot more than crumbs, doesn't he? The leftovers, it's the same thing. And that's why Mark tells you precisely the same. They don't get an inferior version. They get the same thing. And because God is willing to save anybody who will humble themselves and come without a sense of entitlement and ask for mercy. So it's a wonderful thing. I think the feeding of the 4,000, it means God's mercy overflows to dogs. My slogan for it is, and don't misunderstand this, my slogan is, dogs can be saved. I don't mean your pet dog can be. I know Mr. Gustav, my Cocker Spaniel puppy, is very cute, but I don't mean he'll be in heaven. But I mean Gentiles will be saved. And that should be astonishing. The trouble is we take it for granted, don't we? We just know that the salvation is for everybody, so we're not surprised. So you've got to zoom back in salvation history and think, what claim do you have in a Jewish Messiah bringing an Israel exodus for God's chosen people, the children of Abraham? And the answer is none by birth, but by mercy I have a stake because it overflows to anybody. So this is another example of going big, so looking at a bigger section. If you just teach the Syrophoenician woman, you don't notice this, I think. You get similar point, Jesus is kind to her, but you don't get the crumbs and the bread reference, which is so key. If you just teach the feeding of the 4,000, you definitely don't get it. But if you zoom out wide enough to see 5,000, bread and crumbs, 4,000, then you get the whole thing. So go big. But, how are we doing? We've got a little bit of time. That would be, for me, one sermon. But there's another sermon you can do on the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. And at this point, I want to just talk about the question of, does the Bible only have one point? Should my sermon just have one focus? And I want to say yes, and I want to say no. So it's a really good discipline to try and focus your sermon on saying one thing. Even if you've got several points in the sermon, it's all going in one direction. Because people can't handle like loads of different ideas, and it makes more sense in communication. And it also gives something you can drive home. So it's a good question to ask, what is the main thing this passage is saying? And maybe in your prep you notice 10 things, and you've got to answer, if I could choose just one, which would it be? And then ideally you want to ask, if Mark could choose just one, which would it be? What's his main point? So that's a good idea. But that doesn't mean that there's some sort of law that says each passage will only say one thing. I don't think the Bible ever tells you that. It will only say one thing at a time. And sometimes Mark has overlapping ideas. So we've already seen that earlier today. We saw that chapter 2, in the synagogue in Capernaum with the man who Jesus forgives his sins and then heals his paralysis. It's sort of in the chapter 1 section about Jesus showing his kingdom so that you'll leave everything to follow him. And it's also in the chapter 2 section, which is people opposing Jesus for stupid reasons. And it's in both. It's sort of overlap. So Mark's making two different points from that one episode. And the way I would preach it is I do two sermons and I put that passage in both sermons. So I do the chapter 1, 16 to 2, 14 sermon. And then I do the chapter 2, 1 to 3, verse 6 sermon. And it would be in the overlap. Well, the same is true of here. So we've got the Syrophoenician woman comes between the 5,000 and the 4,000. It shows us how they both link. There's another reason they link, and it's in chapter 8. So turn to chapter 8. I'm going to do now what I'm telling you not to do. I'm going to do two sermons in one go. But I'm going to tell you that was one sermon. Here's another sermon. So chapter 8 and verse 11. The Pharisees came and began to argue with Jesus, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, "Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation." Or to paraphrase, "You've had quite enough signs and you didn't pay attention to any of them. I'm not giving you any more." And he left them, got into the boat again and went to the other side. Now they had forgotten to bring bread. And they had only one loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them saying, "Watch out. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." And they began discussing with each other the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? Don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves of the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? They said 12. And the 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? They said 7. And he said to them, do you still not understand? Do you see Jesus' exasperation? He's just bombarding them with questions. Do you not perceive? Are your hearts hardened? Are your eyes blind? Do you not remember? What is wrong with you? Says Jesus. Here's the situation. Jesus has just fed 5,000 people with only 5 loaves. He's just fed 4,000 people with just a few loaves. There are now 12 people and 1 loaf. This is by far the best ratio of bread to mouths that we've had in the whole gospel. And they're going, we haven't got any bread. What are we going to do about lunch? Did you bring bread? Oh, I haven't got any bread. We've forgotten the bread. What are we going to do? And even when Jesus is trying to tell them to beware, and Jesus uses the biblical image of yeast or leaven, the image in the Bible being of corruption that can spread, because as you know, if you make sourdough, as we all do in the 21st century, a little bit of sourdough in non-sourdough, the yeast just spreads and grows through the whole thing. And watch out for the corrupting, spreading influence of the Pharisees. And the only thing they hear is yeast. He said yeast, 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 bread, bakers. We didn't bring lunch. He brought lunch. And they're so obsessed with lunch, they're not even listening to him. And he's saying, do you not get it? Seriously? And the weird thing is that their memories are intact. They can remember the smallest details about the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. But somehow they just haven't done the spiritual math, as the Americans would say. And they are a few loaves short of a picnic, we might say. But the trouble is, it's not just that they're dim. Mark shows us that this sort of failure to understand is a spiritually concerning one. He says, watch out. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. We're looking at Herod later on today, so I won't spoil that. Tomorrow morning, I won't spoil that. But the Pharisees, they're the people who keep asking for signs. And Jesus, you don't need any more signs. I'm not giving you any more signs. You won't listen to the signs I've given you. Jesus, don't be like that. Don't be like the Pharisees who, after miracle upon miracle upon miracle upon miracle, have paid attention to none of them. Watch out. And the Pharisees and the Herodians, remember, as a pair, we've seen them before. Chapter 3, verse 6, they're the people who plotted Jesus' murder. Be careful. Jesus said, do you not perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? That's a terrifying phrase, isn't it? That's the enemy phrase. That's the Pharaoh phrase. Pharaoh refused to respond to God's plagues. We've actually already seen it in chapter 6. We can forgive them for when Jesus says, you know, go and feed these people, and they don't get how. Look, Jesus, you know, we'd never be able to buy enough food for these people even if we spent a year's wages. You can understand that they're confused because they don't know Jesus is about to do a miracle. But when they're confused afterwards, it's more worrying. They didn't understand about the loaves because their hearts were hardened. It's a spiritual thing. Then Jesus makes it worse. Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? It's an allusion to Isaiah chapter 6. Jesus already quoted from it in chapter 4. It's God's judgment on enemies in Isaiah. Because you've rejected me, I'm going to withdraw revelation from you. I'm going to blind your eyes and deafen your ears. So all of these categories, they're not just being slow or being dim. They're being sinful and being evil. Why are you resisting me? Says Jesus to his disciples. And we're starting to really despair at this point because, well, we've had 8 chapters now of amazing revelation. And no progress, it seems, towards understanding. Because they're blind. Culpably blind. Then they came to Bethsaida, and some people brought him a blind man and begged him to touch them. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village. And when he spat on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked them, "Do you see anything?" He looked up and said, "I see men, but they look like trees walking." Then Jesus laid hands on his eyes again. He opened his eyes, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And he sent to him to his village, saying, "Do not even enter the village." Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and others one of the prophets." By the way, that answer makes us very nervous, because we remember what Herod had said in chapter 6. That's something for tomorrow. "What about you?" he says. "Who do you say I am?" "You are the Christ." Oh, Peter! Eureka! And as readers, we're sort of leaping in our seats. Finally! The penny has dropped. How did you work it out, Peter? Because, you know, just before, you were worrying about lunch while on a boat trip with the guy who specialises in big menus from small ingredients. What's changed, Peter? Before, it was like you had eyes but failed to see, and ears but failed to hear. But now you see and you hear. What's happened to you, Peter? And the answer is, Jesus has opened his eyes. Opened the blind man's eyes physically. But Mark sandwiches it together against the structure tool again. He puts the healing of a blind man in between a description of the disciples as being blind, verse 18, "Having eyes do you not see?" and a description of the disciples getting it, "You are the Christ." And Mark arranges it very deliberately. They don't get it. Jesus opens a man's eyes. They do get it. And the point is, it's not miracles that did this for him. He was there at the feeding of the 5,000. He counted the baskets. He remembers how many there were, and he didn't get it. And he was there at the feeding of the 4,000. And weirdly was just as confused. How can we feed all these people in this desert place? Well, you could remember what happened 2 chapters ago, maybe. And he remembers the events and he counted the baskets. None of the evidence, even though it was stacking up very, very high, was enough to convince him. But then Jesus opens his eyes and he gets it. "You are the Christ." What does that mean for us? It means if you're a Christian, you're a Christian because Jesus was very kind to you and opened your eyes. Not because you are spiritually more insightful than the next person by nature. We were all blind. Not because you were less stuck in your sin than the next person. We were all hard-hearted. But because God opened our eyes, he was kind to us. Unless God opened our eyes, no amount of miracles would help. You know, sometimes an unbeliever says, "I'll believe if God would do a miracle." And you think, no, you wouldn't. Because they saw miracles on miracles on miracles. They didn't get it. Well, God does need to do a miracle, but a different kind. He needs to open your blind eyes. If we're Christians, it's because God's opened our eyes. If anyone else is to become a Christian, God must open their eyes. And you see, the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 4,000, Mark has put in both stories. It's like they're two different strands. So on the one hand, there's the Gentiles can be saved sermon. Bread, bread, bread. And I would preach that from the story of the Syrophoenician woman. And on the other hand, there's the by nature we are incredibly blind sermon, which I preach in chapter 8. Do you not remember the feeding of 5,000? Do you not remember the feeding of the 4,000? Have you not worked out that the feeding of the 12 is going to be okay? And then Jesus opens their eyes. And so there's a sort of complexity to it, because we're not looking at an individual paragraph. We're going bigger. We're seeing a whole strand. But two wonderful, wonderful strands. If you're a Gentile today, we can be saved, even though we're dogs. And if you are saved today, it's because God's been merciful to us and for no other reason. Let's pray, shall we? Father, we thank you for both of these messages of Mark. We're sorry, Lord, that we assume that we're entitled, that we have a claim on you, that we have a right to be fed. We thank you, Father, for this woman who is so different to us. She's so humble. And when she's called a dog, she says yes. And she's willing for crumbs. And how we praise you, Lord, for your generosity, that you give far more than crumbs. You give a whole Exodus rescue for Gentile people like us. And Father, we also confess that we are not more insightful than Peter by nature. We are just as stuck. And our failure to understand isn't just an intellectual thing, Lord. It's a rebellious, hard-hearted, spiritual thing. We resist you. And how we praise you for your mercy on us to open our eyes that we might see that you are the Christ. For Jesus' sake, amen.